The state of the union is
slightly economically soft.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, January 25th. Coming up, GM's global sales last year were more global. And it's only Tuesday, but never too early to think about brunch, the best place in the world for it, a little later.
But first, tonight, President Obama talks to the nation about the state of the union. He's expected to say the economy, while growing, needs to kick it up a notch. One thing Republicans will be watching is what the president will say about the deficit. The GOP's answer to Mr. Obama's budget plans is newly tapped House Budget Committee Chairman Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. Now, many Americans will meet the congressman for the first time when he gives the Republican response to the president's speech. Janet Hook is congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She has a profile of Ryan in today's edition. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why are Republicans putting so much budget faith in this guy?
Well, he happens to be one of the best educated members of the House on budget issues. He's really quite a policy wonk. You know, his idea of fun is reading budgets and CBO reports.
Any hint of what he thinks needs cutting from the budget? He's got some ideas, right?
Frankly, I think the man thinks everything needs to be cut in the budget. And so he's proposed something called the Roadmap for America's Future. And it talks about making changes in Social Security, Medicare, and discretionary spending. And that's why he's such a lightning rod, but also why a lot of people respect him for trying to take the big picture on the problem.
Now, he's an up-and-comer in the party, perhaps even a Senate candidate in a couple of years, yet he sided with the Wall Street bailout. How's that going to play with the not-so-Wall Street-y Tea Party?
He got some flack for it at the time. I think that may come back to haunt him if he does pursue higher office. At the time, a lot of Republican leaders did step out and support the bailout of Wall Street. What was significant for him is that he's a big free market advocate. And I think at the time his line was he supported this to basically shore up the free market.
Janet Hook, a congressional reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Janet, thanks.
Thank you.
Now let's get to home prices. They're still falling in most of the nation's major cities, according to the closely watched Case-Shiller Housing Index. All but one city, sunny San Diego, reported monthly declines in home values, and eight cities hit their lowest point since the housing bust began. For more on this, let's bring in Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's our Tuesday regular, and she's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So how much worse can things get in the housing market?
Well, you know, this decline really was not unexpected, except by the chronically hopeful. Right now, we're looking at Shiller still expecting probably a 10% decline, gradual decline over a period of time until we get this housing inventory out. And that's the big problem, is we have a huge amount of housing inventory. The banks are doing this pretend and extend. Pretend the house is full value, extend the time before they repossess.
Right.
But there's no bottom until you resolve the debt situation.
And can we have a recovery, Julie, if we don't reach a bottom and see a recovery in the housing market?
You can have a recovery in sectors. For example, in the energy sector, housing prices went up in Bismarck, Fargo, North Dakota, Texas, almost across the board. Education centers, Champaign-Urbana, and Chicago.
My hometown, Champaign-Urbana.
There you go. It's rising. Government, Boston and D.C., financial services, Connecticut, those sectors are rising, and the housing market is rising there. But for the rest of the United States, we still have this huge problem of unemployment and industries not coming back. And that's where we're going to have a big debt problem. Consumers have to pay down the debt, limit new spending, banks have to write everything off their ghost assets, and the biggest problem you're faced with there is that default or defer. The company basic is looking at the economy, pick up enough to bring back demand and prices. Right now, it's just prayer, and I've found over the years prayer is not a really good effective portfolio management tool, but the banks have to write all of this off before we can have a real turnaround here in all the pricing.
Okay, Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much for your time.
You bet.
The continued weakness in housing is what concerns Jeff Merkley, the Democratic senator from Oregon. He wants the president to talk tonight about boosting aid to struggling homeowners because of what he says is the failure of the mortgage modification program, such as the one known as HAMP.
That's the Home Affordable Modification Program. And Senator Merkley is here with us now to talk about all this. Hi, Senator.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Well, what would you like President Obama to say, particularly when it comes to foreclosure efforts?
I'd like him to say that 300,000 foreclosure filings a month affecting almost 7 million families over the last 2 years is absolutely unacceptable, that our major national program for this isn't doing the job the way it should, and so we're going to make a renewed national effort to assist families.
Well, aren't you worried, though, that the fundamentals are not strong, that even if you were to have this improvement with HAMP, that you still have people that are really hanging on by a thread in terms of their ability to pay their mortgages, and they'll eventually get foreclosed on anyway?
When homes are being sold, and they're being sold at fire sale prices, in many cases, the family that's in the home could actually repurchase the home in what I've called a short refinance program, and it would stabilize the family and stabilize the community, and this would be a win-win all the way around. So that's another point.
I noticed just the other day that President Obama got rid of his Economic Recovery Advisory Board. It's now called the Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. Are you worried that this is a president who's moving on? He's not really thinking about foreclosures anymore.
Well, certainly I don't see how any president couldn't be thinking about foreclosures when there's been really no improvement, and 2011 looks to be very much like 2010. That's why I'm urging him to address this in the State of the Union, because let's realize that housing got us into this recession.
Right.
And as long as housing is a mess, we're going to be in a recession for a very long time.
Senator, before I let you go, everybody in Congress is talking about how great it would be to cut spending, but no one seems to be able to come up with something they'd actually like to cut. So here is your chance. Is there anything in particular you would put on the chopping block?
I think we have to look very seriously at our war in Afghanistan. I think the purposes for it have changed, and we're spending $1 million per soldier, and we need to think about spending more of those dollars back here in the United States of America.
Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat of Oregon, thanks so much for your time this morning.
You're so welcome. It's great to be with you.
We could hear the president tonight talk about some of the investments the government has happily shed from its portfolio in recent days. In fact, today, the Treasury Department is starting to auction off its so-called warrants in Citigroup. Now, warrants allow the holder to buy Citigroup shares at discounted prices, and the government has, a half billion of them. Here's Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon.
This pretty much closes the book on Citi's TARP bailout, according to Morningstar banking analyst Jamie Peters.
The government will no longer own any sort of voting shares for Citigroup after these warrants are sold.
Citigroup's back in the black, and taxpayers already got a thank you last year from CEO Vikram Pandit.
The bridge to the other side to a sound footing came from the American people, and I want to thank our country for providing TARP funding.
And besides a thank you, what did taxpayers get? This latest sale is expected to add a little more to the $12 billion the government figures it's already made. Critics worry it's also established a bad precedent, even though then-Treasury official Herb Allison insisted last year that wasn't the case with Citigroup.
There is no too-big-to-fail guarantee on the part of the U.S. government.
New reforms call for the orderly unwinding of big banks that fail, but Peters at Morningstar isn't convinced that would happen.
If it was a Citigroup-only situation, it's possible they'd let it unwind. If it's everybody, we're going to see another bailout.
In the event, that is, of an unforeseen reversal of fortune. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
So tonight we'll hear from the president. Tomorrow we'll get a report from the Federal Reserve on this week's meeting to hammer out policies for the coming year. With some economic growth, will the Fed reevaluate plans to inject billions into the economy? Here's Marketplace's David Gura.
The short answer is no. Joseph Gagnon is an economist at the Peterson Institute.
It's difficult for me to conceive or imagine that any economic data we've seen or could see in the next few days or have seen in the last few weeks could possibly change their mind.
He says weekly numbers about housing or unemployment don't usually change Fed policy. Marvin Goodfriend agrees. He's a professor at Carnegie Mellon.
I don't think the numbers have changed enough to warrant a rethinking of the overall strategy.
Goodfriend expects the Fed will keep buying bonds, hoping to encourage investment and keep interest rates low.
It's always good to follow through with your plans unless you have exceptionally good reasons to stop doing so.
One good reason would be inflation. He says the Fed's keeping an eye on bond markets. So far, there's been some investor nervousness.
But not enough, in my opinion, to cause the Fed to stop and not follow through on its full $600 billion purchases.
According to Goodfriend, if the Fed feels like it needs to change course, it could.
But we're nowhere near that yet.
The Fed plans to buy its last round of bonds in June. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, January 25th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson. Don't forget, you can get the latest look at the markets anytime, day or night, by checking out the numbers section at marketplace.org.
Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world.
General Motors reported this week it fell several thousand cars short of Toyota in the number of cars sold around the world. But here's an interesting fact. For the first time in the automaker's 102-year history, GM sold more cars in a foreign market than in the U.S., Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports.
That foreign market happens to be China, the fastest-growing automobile market on the planet. GM sold 200,000 more vehicles in China than it sold at home. Sounds like good news, but there's a caveat.
The average price of the car that GM sells in China is about half of the price of a car it sells in the United States.
Michael Dunn is finishing a book about GM's success in China. He points out that not only are GM's cars cheaper in China, but the company also has to share its profits.
GM is a minority shareholder in China. So for every car it gets sold, it collects half of the revenues.
So for GM's bean counters, the numbers from China don't look that impressive. GM's growth sure does, though. 12 years ago, the company sold just 20,000 Buicks in China. This year, they sold 2.4 million vehicles. Last week's visit from President Hu Jintao saw a $900 million deal to export Cadillacs, Buicks, and Chevys, all signs that GM's growth isn't likely to slow down anytime soon. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, you weren't in our Los Angeles office today, but our co-worker and friend, Jolie Podokis, brought this giant chocolate bar into work today. So I apologize. If we could transmit it over the phone, we would do that, but we can't,
unfortunately. I appreciate that. I always miss the sweet stuff out
you
here.
You do. You do. But you'll soon have that when you move to Los Angeles. It was a pretty pricey, by the way, piece of candy. But what's happening in the Ivory Coast could make that chocolate bar even more expensive. Ivory Coast is the world's biggest producer of cocoa, the key ingredient for chocolate, of course. And a two-month-old election stalemate has one presidential contender calling for a month-long ban on the overseas sale of cocoa. The BBC's John James is with us now from Abidjan, which is the Ivory Coast's commercial capital. Hi, John.
Hi, Steve.
A cocoa ban from one of the biggest cocoa sellers. I mean, is this going to raise the price of my chocolate here in the United States?
Well, there's probably a good chance that it might, actually. I mean, generally, cocoa prices have been high for the last few years, and this announcement has raised the price of cocoa on the markets by about 5%. So we're already at year-long highs. Certainly, cocoa is getting more expensive, and that, of course, is a key ingredient in chocolate.
Well, now, why is cocoa being used as a political weapon, and how effective is that ban going to be?
Well, we'll have to see the impact. I mean, cocoa is the major export here in Ivory Coast. This produces around a third of world supply. It's a key means, really, for Laurent Gbagbo to carry on in power. He's the president who, according to most of the world, lost the elections in November, but he's still determined to carry on. And getting money from cocoa sales is probably one of the key ways that he can carry on paying salaries and being in government. So it's seen as a way to sort of strangulate his financial control and just make it more difficult for him to carry on and possibly force him to accept the democratically elected leader, Alassane Ouattara, in the eyes of most of the world.
All right, the BBC's John James in Abidjan. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, back here at home in this country, Chicago sure likes hometown loyalty. Steve, you heard, I'm sure, about Rahm Emanuel yesterday. He was kicked off the mayoral ballot because judges think he hasn't lived in Chicago long enough. But here's a guy who's got him beat, John Stone. He was fired from his job at a car dealership in suburban Chicago because he wore a Green Bay Packers tie.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. They don't like that.
No.
Stone wore the tie yesterday to celebrate the Packers' victory over the Bears on Sunday. His boss gave him five opportunities to take the tie off and keep his job. Well, he kept the tie, and he is now looking for a job.
You know, the only thing worse than wearing a Packers tie on a day like after the Sunday loss to the Packers, of course, would be wearing a St. Louis Cardinals tie in Chicago.
Oh.
That would be even worse, I can tell you.
Mm. You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, January 25th. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in L.A., I'm Steve Chiotakis. Check out our website for the latest numbers, updated podcasts, and fun and excitement, too, such as voting on what fee is the next in the arsenal of airline fees so they can keep making profits up in the sky. Well, that's all at our website, marketplace.org.
Well, Steve, it's only Tuesday, but it is never too early to think about brunch. And according to Crain's New York Business, the brunch capital of the USA is New York City.
Hey.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth is here with me in the studio with more. Good morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
So are people really having more brunch here in New York than in other places?
Well, the magazine asked Google, and apparently we made 35% more brunch-related searches last year than anybody else. At Sarah Beth's, which, as you know, is a classic brunch place here, has a couple of locations, brunch volume is reportedly up 10%. And the Waldorf Astoria, which charges a whopping $95 a person for its weekend brunch, says it can't keep up with demand.
$95 for brunch, it sounds like we might be well out of the recession at this point.
Well, actually, the Waldorf aside, some people think brunch is big because of the recession.
Huh.
You know, it's a way to enjoy a nice meal without spending as much as you would for dinner. Plus, there are all those deals out there where you might get a free drink or two with your food, so it's more of a bargain.
All right, Elisa, one real big question here. What's your favorite brunch, savory or sweet?
Well, I don't want to be a party pooper. I actually prefer breakfast or lunch, not the combination. but if I had to choose, I'd definitely pick a really good bagels and lox.
And they're not hard to find here in New York City. Marketplace's Elisa Roth in the brunch capital of the USA. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, Jeremy, people who invent things in this country look to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to protect those ideas.
Yep.
But right now, there is a huge backlog. More than 700,000 applications are still waiting to be processed. And as part of an effort to clear that logjam, the agency is now going to open its first office outside of Washington, in Detroit. Michigan Radio's Sarah Hewlett reports.
David Kapos is the director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and his assessment of how long it takes to grant a patent is pretty blunt.
In a word, it's too long.
Kapos says on average, it takes about 2 years just to get someone to read your application, then another year after that to hear whether you've been granted a patent.
You know, it's really a major economic drain valued at billions of dollars a year when the government is sitting on patent applications that are all about job creation and opportunity creation for our country.
Sean Quinn understands the long wait for a patent all too well. Quinn is an engineer at General Motors. He is taking me through a door inside a cavernous testing facility at the company's proving ground west of Detroit.
As you can tell, this room is quite quiet. Some of the testing that I personally worked on in here is modal testing on the next generation full-size pickup trucks. This is the room where, you know, we work on keeping our cars quiet and keeping them vibration-free.
That's Quinn's specialty, and he submitted 18 patent applications related to that and other work over the past several years. He's been awarded 4, but the rest hang in limbo, including one for a concept that was shown to suppliers to help GM figure out how to put it into production. That patent application was submitted in 2004.
Two suppliers to date have looked at the execution, developed their production solution, gone ahead and patented it, and received a U.S. filing on that. And we're the originators of the idea, and we still do not have our own patent here.
The Detroit office will open this summer and hire 100 patent examiners. Officials say they chose Detroit in part because the auto industry submits so many patent applications. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Hewlett for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, in case you don't already know this, people are watching you on your Facebook or MySpace page. Did you know this?
What are you talking about?
Friends and foes alike, including the bank, checking out photos of your shopping spree. Maybe you went to, I don't know, the Galleria or wherever, the Herald Square over there in New York, and the big Macy's store. Thieves, of course, know when you're out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And now, according to the Los Angeles Times, life insurance companies, Jeremy, are making sure you're really living the healthiest lifestyle. Because they can tell by your pictures. Insurance consultant Celent did this study suggesting stuff found on social networking sites could be used to set policy prices in the future. So maybe you have that photo showing you smoking.
over
not
on your
smoking
Facebook?
For me, but, yeah, but
yeah, well, not smoking for me either. But or skydiving? How about that?
I don't go skydiving, but I definitely, yeah. I mean, I went parasailing or whatever it's called, where you're on the back of a boat. Maybe that. I hope they didn't get any pictures of that.
Yeah. Ouch. That's not good. That's not good. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles,
and I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.